I want to talk about in this session about pilgrimage and connect pilgrimage with the idea of final causes. Now, some of you I know have read Aristotle. By the way, I had read some Aristotle when I came to Dante, but it didn't touch me somehow. I don't know. It was somehow distant from me. But when I saw it in Inferno, it kind of went in, and it's an arrow that never came out, and for good or for bad, this is what happens to some of us. But I want to talk about first the idea of, is such a pilgrimage possible? Somebody asked about that in the last session. Did he really do this? And in his letter to his patron Congrande della Scala, which I already mentioned, which is kind of a long, if you printed it out, it would probably be 7 or 8 pages. But it's worth looking at, because he talks about how, in a way, the poem has multiple senses, like the 4 senses of scripture, what he intended to do by this. And then he asks a question that we think is a modern question, but was a question in the Middle Ages as well. You know, people are asking, is such a journey possible? So here's what he says to his patron. This will maybe get us going. I'm quoting here from the letter. The human intellect at the end of life, because of the inborn nature and affinity which it has for the separate intellectual substance. I don't exactly understand that. Maybe the Dominicans can tell us what that is. When it is raised to such an extent that memory is lacking after its return, since it transcended humankind. And this is shown to us by the apostle, meaning St. Paul, speaking to the Corinthians, where he says, I know a man, whether in the body or out of the body, I know not, God knoweth, caught up to the third heaven. And he saw the secret things of God, which is not granted to man to utter. Thus, after the and now Dante's back speaking in his own voice, thus, after the intellect surpasses human reason in its ascension, it does not remember those things which took place outside of it. I'll come back to that in a bit. But he continues a little bit further on. This is worth paying attention to. But if these arguments are not sufficient for scoffers, let them read Richard of St. Victor in the book On Contemplation. If you've studied medieval philosophy, the Victorines are kind of a mystical group in the High Middle Ages. He says, let them read Richard of St. Victor in the book On Contemplation. Let them read Bernard, St. Bernard of Clairvaux, in the book On Consideration, and let them read Augustine in the book On the Capacity of the Soul, which in Latin is De Quantitate Animae. And they will not scoff. But if they should object to the possibility of elevation because of the sinful nature of the person speaking, let them read Daniel, where they will find that even Nebuchadnezzar saw a vision against sinners. So there are, just as a preliminary, I want to point out there are two things going on in these texts. One is he's affirming this possibility with some of the absolute highest authorities in his time. I mean, Bernard of Clairvaux was... We usually think of Thomas Aquinas as this central thinker of this period. And of course, he is, just in terms of pure thinker. But Bernard of Clairvaux was involved in counseling popes. Actually, the book On Consideration that Dante mentions here is six. It's a text with 6 chapters that they call books, of course, in the Middle Ages. And the first 5 chapters are telling the pope, who had been a student of Bernard of Clairvaux's, don't get caught up in administration. Don't hear too many lawsuits. Don't hear all these disputes. Your real job as the shepherd of souls is contemplation. And it's only in book 6 of the 6 that Bernard of Clairvaux says that to the Pope. So Bernard is a high-ranking figure. Bernard was the inspirer of the Second Crusade, which turned out to be a disaster. Bernard was involved in a schism, a real schism, when there were 2 popes for 8 years during his lifetime, and he was trying to persuade people on one side or another, and they would fall, rulers would fall back this way or that, so it drove him crazy until finally, the way the schism was resolved in his time was one of the candidates died. which actually didn't resolve it because the disputes kept going on from one party or another, but at least there wasn't a second pope that they were pointing to. So he's really pulling out all the stops here and saying that this is indeed possible, right? And then in that second passage that I read, he's talking about how it's impossible when the intellect transcends human ways of speaking. He develops this a lot in Paradiso, by the way. When the human intellect transcends our normal modes of thinking and perceiving and speaking, it isn't just that it can't because it's forbidden or something. It doesn't know how to speak about those things. And in fact, he says in Paradiso, if I remember the lines of this right, he says, let it be a grace enough for those who hear this until the experience will serve them. So in other words, you've got to actually go through this. You can't just hear about it. It's good. It helps orient you toward what you ought to be doing in your life, but it's not possible entirely, even for the greatest poet, to explain this. I have just one tercet from the first canto in Paradiso where he says, to soar beyond the human, as the translation says that, the actual verb is one that Dante made up, transumanar, didn't exist in his time, not trans in the gender sense. What is this new thing? Transhumanism is it's called, right? Well, this is in a mystical sense. He's saying transhumanar, to pass beyond the human, cannot be described in words. Oh, here it is. Yes, let the example be enough to one for whom grace holds this experience in store. Now, in the Paradiso, which is our primary focus here, what he's dealing with is a lot more understandable. Most of us are not going to have the experiences of the Inferno. And in a way, it's odd that he included that. Maybe it was his sense of, I don't know, proportion and balance, or maybe it was actually part of that experience he had after Beatrice died. But you don't necessarily have to see all evil before you can see all good. It's there, and it's helpful to us. In fact, when Dante gets to the bottom of hell, and he sees Satan, remember Satan has three heads, and he's chomping on people, and he's got bat-like wings, and he's frozen in ice, right? I always tell people, it's like a China, you know, they still have these so-called Chinese handcuffs where the more you try to pull out, the tighter it gets. So the more he tries to fly away from the reality which is God's creation, the firmer he's frozen in his own torture. So it's a very rich image that he gives us there. But when Dante sees Satan, he says, I didn't die, but I did not remain alive. What? You know? Even the vision of evil somehow transcends the ability of normal speech to be to be adequately expressed. So even though we don't have to have that experience of evil, he included it probably for the sake of balance of what he's doing. But if we are going to make the ascent, if we're going to make a pilgrimage, we are going to have to go, all of us, in some sense, through purgatory, and maybe a few saints who go directly to heaven, we don't know. And maybe one of the surprising things about us is that even heaven is not just an automatic, you know, we're there and that's it. The great Italian philosopher Benedetto Croce, who was kind of a Hegelian, got into a dispute, I think, with T.S. Eliot in the early part of the 20th century, and he said that Dante's got heaven all wrong. Croce wasn't a believer, so why he thought he should have an opinion about heaven, I don't know. But he said it should have just been this lyric poem of, you know, light and sound, and Dante doesn't see it that way. He sees that there are going to be greater and lesser souls even in heaven, which may cause us to pause a bit, but, you know, St. Matthew left the tax collecting and became a great saint, and are any of us going to do anything as great as that? Isn't his reward supposed to be greater than maybe somebody who didn't do quite as much? Now, in Dante, just so we're clear about the structure again, in Dante, heaven is not quite what it looks like as you're going up. Because, you know, you start with the people who were unfaithful to their vows, and then you start to ascend to people who wavered on sexual matters and Venus, and then you start to get to the good rulers and the philosophers and great saints and whatnot. But when we get up to the very upper reaches of heaven, there's what's called the celestial rose. If any of you have read that, you probably remember this. And Dante is told that for the sake of his own capacities, he was shown things in a kind of a graduated way. But in fact, all the souls really live in this like one flower that's up there. So there is inequality, and then there's some kind of equality ultimately at the end of the pilgrimage as well. But okay, I want to return. I always tell myself I'm going to read a text and I get ideas, and I'm sorry, I get off on these things. If you read Aristotle and the Scholastics, you know that there are four causes that they identify, right? There's a material cause, that means the matter that makes something, you know, exist. There's a formal cause, the form that the thing has. There's an efficient causes. Somebody had to physically put this together, or God created something with efficient causes. And then there are final causes. And as I was saying in the last session, the final cause is the reason why all the other causes exist, right? You build a lectern so that someday somebody can stand in it and read a text from it. Or you build a coffee machine so that somebody can have a cup of coffee at a certain point. God makes the universe for, you know, reasons we don't understand, but we kind of get glimpses of it as we think into it. And we tend not to pay much attention in modern science. Actually, we don't at all. They were eliminated in the scientific revolution. We don't have final causes because people like Descartes and Francis Bacon and others thought that final causes impeded the actual scientific study of how things work. And I mean, it's hard to know the weight of another period's intellectual life, but it looked to them as if somehow using final causes wasn't allowing them to do science proper. And the science that has followed that, of course, has been great. But in terms of human life, we can't do without those final causes. You know, why do we exist? Well, you know, you get up in the morning and you come to a lecture, you give a lecture, and you go back to your college and you're studying because you're going to get a job as a musician or as an economist or as a scientist or whatever, a theologian, whatever it's going to be. But why do you do that? You know, what is the final goal of where everything is going to come together? Why is it there? Now, when we talk about final causes with regard to human beings, there are two large answers that are possible. I mean, you can obviously deny them, and then which is largely what we do now. Each of us makes up his or her own reason for being alive or not being alive. You know. Dante and much of the tradition gather together around two large possibilities. One is the kind of thing you see in Aristotle. In Aristotle's Ethics, that you pursue certain virtues in order to achieve eudaimonia, which is happiness. Now, happiness doesn't mean, like Homer Simpson drinking the vodka with the mayonnaise, you know, just in the moment. Happiness means a full life that's fulfilling, that's meaningful, that has a certain amount of pleasure and a certain amount of wealth, but it doesn't mean simply pursuing pleasant things along the way, right? Happiness is in this sense, happiness is a terrestrial, this worldly thing that has a certain end to it. Now, the other thing that transcends the earthly life, of course, is the life of beatitude. So eudaimonia is for this life. Beatitude is sort of a transcendent happiness that's eternal. It's perfectly satisfying, and that we achieve in this life, if we achieve it, by contemplation. Now, just to complicate things a bit, those of you who have actually read Aristotle's Ethics know that in Book 10, Dante calls Aristotle, by the way, il maestro di coloro che sanno. He's the master of those who know. Middle Ages kind of thought he knew everything, and I'm kind of inclined to think it was pretty close to correct, actually. But Aristotle says in Book 10 of the Ethics, and I'm just going to read you this passage. It's a famous passage for people who pay attention to these things. You think Aristotle is building solely toward eudaimonia. He's looking around at excess and defect, and you know what make people, what he sees makes people happy in the polis. And then he says, we should strive to go as far as possible into contemplation. Now, he doesn't mean the same thing as a Christian would mean by this, but listen to this. This is in Book 10. But such a life would be too high for man, for it is not insofar as he is a man that he will live so, but insofar as something divine is present in him. And by so much as this is superior to our composite nature, body and soul being matter and form, composite nature, in its activity superior to that which is the exercise of the other kind of virtue. If reason is divine, then in comparison with man, the life according to it is divine in comparison with human life. But we must not follow those who advise us, being men and women, to think of human things, and being mortal, of mortal things, but must, so far as we can, make ourselves immortal, and strain every nerve to live in accordance with the best thing in us. For even if it be small in bulk, much more does it in power and worth surpass everything. Now that's a pagan. That's a pagan thinking about when you've done everything that you can do to be happy in this life, that is something that still belongs to human reason. Still, we might ask whether Dante, by the way, had read and, like many of these medievals, seemingly memorized all these books that he's read. He's read Aristotle, and he knows how to draw on all this when he has a need to do so. I want to read again that passage from the Vita Nuova in light of what we've just been saying about contemplation and the idea of a pilgrimage. Because in a way, we'd have to say that Aristotle kind of sees it, but it's a much more static kind of pilgrimage than seems to take place in a Christian context. I've walked the Camino. I don't know if any of you have ever walked one of these large walking pilgrimages, but it really does something for you to have body, mind, and spirit all kind of moving along in one direction towards something. Remember Dante says this. I'm going to read this again from the end of La Vita Nuova. A marvelous vision appeared to me, in which I saw things that made me decide not to say anything more about this blessed lady until I was capable of writing about her more worthily. Strange. Dante understands as a great poet. Early on in the Vita Nuova, he says, even when he's in normal love, he's kind of like a normal babbler. You know, in love, when he's with her, he doesn't know what to say. And he says, if the things I say sound stupid, and the things that I want to say, I can never get out. And so love does that too. Write about her more worthily. To achieve this, I am doing all that I can, as surely she knows, so that if it be pleasing to him who is that for which all things live, and if my life is long enough, I hope to say things about her that have never been said about any woman. I think that has to be both human love and contemplative. A lot of people who read these things in Dante in modern times have used the more eudaimonistic part of Dante almost to make him into a kind of a self-help guru. And up to a point, that's not entirely wrong. There's a very good book by one of the older American literary critics. His name is Francis Ferguson. He's got a book called Purgatorio, Dante's Drama of the Mind. And he limits himself, I think he knows better than this, but he decides that he's going to write this book that's going to show how passing through the purgations and the development of the virtues in purgatory is a way to discover the self. This is a very modern thing to do, right? To look at ourselves and figure out how can I arrive at my true identity, my true self. Now, you can laugh about this, and I do quite a bit, actually, when I see it, because without God, we don't know who we are. You know, we kind of float in whatever. But he wrote a very interesting book, and it's really actually worth reading, how within the context of just the purgatory, reading this as a modern literary critic, you can see in Dante many ways that you can discover important and authentic things about yourself. More recently, Rod Dreher. Well, most of you probably know Rod Dreher, who wrote The Benedict Option. You mostly all know him? Yeah. Rod's a friend, and Rod wrote a book called How Dante Can Save Your Life, which I'm sad to say he shouldn't have done. Because Dante helped him. Rod moved back to Louisiana. He's from Louisiana. And he and his father had problems, and he thought that when he moved back, he was going to be in a caring, organic community again. And he and his father fought to the day his father died, and you know, it was kind of a disaster. But while he was in the midst of his depression and low energy and whatnot, he somehow stumbled onto Dante. And in the odd ways of things, Dante spoke to him, and he realized that there were things there that he had made a kind of an idol out of his family, and that the kind of transcendence that Dante leads you toward was at least partly helpful to him to transcending these human limitations that he had. I wrote a review of this book in First Things, which you can look up if you have a mind to. Actually, I wrote two, and they didn't like the first one that I wrote, because I actually wrote about the book. And unfortunately, Dante isn't in the forefront of the book quite the way I would want him to have been. Rod and his psychological problems are more there. Nonetheless, I mean, it's a kind of an interesting book. And the editing, he wrote me later, he said, I'm kind of ashamed of this, but the editing didn't work out right. And so, you know, there are these sort of self-help things that Rod does, like, you know, three ways to use canto so-and-so to, you know, to liberate yourself from so-and-so in your life. Well, that's not how you do Dante. I mean, the way you really do Dante is you let him speak to you, and you keep going back to him, and you go deeper and deeper into what it means to do that type of pilgrimage. Yet, it helps people. You know, it helped me when I was a freshman at university, and it seems to help Dante in a variety of ways, some eudaimonistic, some obviously more toward the beatitude end of things. Now, it's worth remembering that a pilgrimage is something unusual, I think, to Christianity, or at least to the biblical story is maybe the way to put it, because you have the Hijra in Islam. You have a lot of Jews who go back to, you know, used to go to Jerusalem for the high holidays. But it's primarily that story of Abraham leaving Ur of the Chaldees and going to the land that God had promised to him that sets the model for what become Christian pilgrimages. It's always going back to, you know, some particular order of things that is willed by God. Now, the two exceptions to this in the classical world are the Odyssey, but that's not really a pilgrimage. That's Ulysses going through various escapades and then eventually getting home and killing the suitors and becoming the king and returning to, and becoming the king. It isn't really a pilgrimage in the sense that Christianity would think of it. The Aeneid is a little bit closer. That's the other exception. The Aeneid, as you know, is the story of when the Greeks sack Troy. Aeneas is one of the princes of Troy, and he takes his father and his son, and they set out across the Mediterranean, and they eventually found Rome, which I'm going to show you is an important thing for Dante. Virgil, I think, speaks to Dante in terms of pilgrimage, because Virgil talks at the beginning of the Aeneid, Zeus says, imperium sine fine dedi. He says, I gave the Romans imperium, rule without end. So contrary to Augustine, remember I said in the previous lecture that Augustine thought that Rome was the city of man, that it was a, a virtuous city in many ways, which is why it grew to be so successful, but it was really a kind of a collective egotism rather than the city of charity and the kind of thing that, you know, the New Jerusalem, as if we want to talk in biblical terms. So I want to go back to the beginning, the second canto of Inferno, because this helps us understand pilgrimage, okay? In the second canto, the poets are setting out. So they've left the dark wood. They're actually going to set out on this pilgrimage, and Dante has second thoughts. And I think this is a subtle humor, and see if you think so too. So Dante speaks to Virgil, and he says this. He says, "Poet, you guide me here. Be on your guard, lest my power fail me before you make me face that plunging pass. You tell us how the father of Silvius, while in the flesh to the eternal world, journeyed with all his senses still alert." If you know book 6 of the Aeneid, when the Trojans land near Naples, they go down with the Cumaean Sibyl. They go down into the afterlife. And in book 6, actually, there's an articulation of there are some who are suffering the pains of the damned. There are some who are in the Elysian fields. There are some souls who, like in Plato, are going to be they're going to be purified and then reincarnated. So Dante and the medievals read this, and they think that Virgil is kind of a prophet. He's been given an insight into the afterlife. So he says, you know, you say that while Aeneas was still alive, he went down into the afterlife. He says, but if the enemy of every evil was kind to him, meaning God, considering the high purpose he performed and who and what he was, this is not hard for us to understand. Since in the highest heaven, he was chosen father of honored Rome and of her empire. The two, city and empire, to tell the truth, were destined to become the holy place where the successor of mighty Peter sits. So Dante sees the orderly, this worldly, eudaimonistic Rome, and then he also sees the Rome of the popes and the Rome of the church as having been made possible by this pilgrimage that Aeneas made to the other world. Then he turns to another example, which we just had a reference to. Later, the chosen vessel, which is who? St. Paul, the Vasa Lectionis. Later, the chosen vessel journeyed beyond to bring back reassurance in the faith, which is the source of the way to salvation. Okay, so Aeneas went down, Paul went up. And now Dante asks, but I, why should I go? Who gives permission? I am not Aeneas, nor am I Paul. Not I nor anyone else would judge me worthy. So if I surrender myself to going there, I fear that the undertaking shall prove folly. You are wise. You see more than I can say. Now, this is a reaction all of us might have setting off on a journey like this, and maybe not even as challenging a journey as this, right? And here's what Virgil responds. You can kind of see him looking, you know, down like this. He says, if I have grasped the meaning of your words, that soul of generosity responded, your heart has been beset by cowardice, which often places burdens on a man to turn him back from honorable deeds like some animal frightened by its shadow. You know, there's a tendency to pass over this and we say, oh yeah, that's Dante, he's afraid to do this. But if we're going to take the idea that this is the story of coming to yourself in the middle of our life, nostra vita, this is something we all have to be prepared to face, that this journey that we all are going to have to go on, whether, you know, at the time of our death in the ways that Father was talking about yesterday, or if you're lucky in some other way, this is a challenging thing. In a way, Dante is just being realistic to say, you know, who am I to make a journey to heaven? But it's precisely the answer of Christianity that you're a child of God and that everybody is going to make the journey in one direction or another, and you take it on at the time when God wants you to do it. Now, I don't have time to get into this, but the thing that actually convinces Dante, if you remember this drama, is Virgil says, look, there were three women up in heaven. Women always solve problems like this for men. I'm going to say this as a guy. Virgin Mary goes to Rachel, who is the, maybe it's St. Lucy, I can't remember this. But anyways, the second one, an intermediary, and says, go talk to Beatrice. Her boyfriend is in trouble. She goes to Beatrice. She says, okay, I'll take care of it. She goes down and talks to Virgil. Virgil says, okay, I'll do what you want. And the minute Dante hears that Beatrice's name is behind it, he says, I was like a flower that was wilting, and suddenly I popped up again, and I said to him, lead on, I'm ready to go. So these intermediaries of grace are interlaced with this very human fear about going on a pilgrimage like this, because there's no escaping this. He's going to have to do it one way or another, and he's lucky enough that he's got these great patronesses, these women behind him. Okay, now we want to talk, I think, a bit about how this poem describes the pilgrimage. And now we're going to move up to the Purgatorio. Once they come out of the fissure in the earth, okay, it's kind of a strange thing. They see the vision of Satan, and then Virgil says, hold on to my back, and Virgil climbs up the hairy legs of Satan. When he fell like this, he produced a dimple on the other side of the world. He's upside down in the ground. And as they come out, the earth that the devil displaced when he fell is now the mountain of Purgatory. So they're on this island. And they have to climb. Virgil climbed up the hairy legs of Satan until they come out. And after all that horribleness and smoke and dirt and fraud and screaming and noises and whatnot, they come out onto this island in what we would call the South Pacific. And here's what Dante writes. Soft coloring of oriental sapphire, collecting in the calm face of the sky, clear right up to the edge of the horizon, brought back the light again into my eyes. As soon as I had stepped out from the dead air which overburdened both my sight and breast, the beautiful, love-provoking planet was making the whole East break into smiles. Love-provoking planet here is Venus. There's a lot of astrology in here, and pure astronomy, too, that I can't go into. Veiling the fishes that follow in her train. I turned then to the right and fixed my mind on the other pole and saw there four stars, which after the first people, none have seen. Father mentioned this last night. I don't believe anybody from the Northern Hemisphere had ever traveled to the Southern Hemisphere at that point who had reported back to the Europeans. So Dante is just winging it here, and he happens to be right. I remember I was in Brazil at a friend's house one time, and I looked up, and there was the Southern Cross, and I said, yeah, that's Dante. But those are the cardinal virtues. Those four stars, most interpreters think of those as the cardinal virtues, and those are going to be developed, and they were naturally possessed by Adam and Eve before they fell, of course. So what you have in that beautiful description is the rediscovery and the renewal of nature. And it's when he steps out of what is the blighting of the creation in hell that all this stuff is now going to become part of a pilgrimage. It's going to be sensuous. It's going to be beautiful nature. As you may have noticed, if you've read the Purgatorio, there's a lot of music in Purgatorio. There's a lot of poetry. There are these friezes, you know, of various classical and biblical scenes, and it's a fuller, more creative, beautiful world that now he exists in, and that he's going to be able to actually make some spiritual progress. And in a way, you could almost say that the pilgrimage really starts here. That the other stuff apparently was meant to free him from those three beasts that Father was talking about and other evils that somehow unconsciously he was attached to. And now, you know, now he's able to step out on the true path. So very striking, there's a very striking passage, there's a very striking line forget whether it's in the Purgatory or in Inferno, where he says, "Tanto ero pieno di sonno quando la verace via
abbandonai,
something like that." He says, I was so full of sleep. Yeah, abbandonai, yes, of course. When I abandoned the true way." So he's aware that somehow he got off track, but he isn't aware how. And this is the mysterium in Iniquitatis. Now he's back on the right path. You know, he's rediscovered this right path. This is going to be an entirely different kind of thing. Now, we talked about last night when he meets Casella. Casella, the Florentine musician who had set some of his poems to music, and he sings Amor che non mente mi ragiona. And how Cato then intervenes and says, you know, what are you guys doing here? Get going. Why are you messing around? Now, I want to just make a couple of comments in addition to what Father made last night about Cato. It is odd that Cato is here. But Dante, in the Italian, it's much more trenchant. And what actually happens is this is a place where Virgil isn't all that good. We'd think that one ancient Roman speaking to another ancient Roman would, you know, they'd kind of understand each other. But Virgil actually starts to bribe Cato. He says, look, you know, let us in. And because Cato says, what are you people coming out of hell? What are you doing here? You're not coming to my mountain. And Virgil kind of says to him, look, you know, God wants this to happen. We're going to pass through. Let us go. And when we go back to limbo, we'll tell your dear wife, Marcia, that we saw you. And Cato says, look, I loved that woman more than anything while I was still alive, but that can't affect what I think right now. This is another step that has to be taken, that even the deepest human loves, as in the Paolo Francesca thing, sure, they're true, and they can be referred to, but the pilgrimage is going to go forward on the basis of something else. And I think that we have to recognize this is an interesting addition to the fact that then Virgil tries to flatter him. He says, you know, Dante is seeking libertà, che è si cara come sa chi per lei libertà vita rifiuta. He says, you know, he's seeking liberty as one would understand who gave up life for it. You know, in a way, it's kind of a Christian idea that you're not going to be submissive to a wrong order of things, but it's not quite. That's why Cato is not going to be in purgatory and then later in heaven, although there are some classical figures in heaven who are just persons. So let's look at one other factor here about why Cato tells them to get going. And this is a place where unless you look carefully in multiple readings of the Divine Comedy, you won't see this. Because there are a lot of great people who get off the boat from the mouth of the Tiber, Casella and others. They're saved souls. They're fortunate souls. Dante meets others. But it takes him 9 cantos before he gets to the first stairway in purgatory. Now, that's 9 out of 33. And if you take away 28 to 33, which is basically the earthly paradise, it's exactly 1/3 of purgatory. So the implication is that we all kind of mess around an awful lot before we even when we're in the best of circumstances to begin the ascent that we need to take on. And he meets various groups of people who haven't attempted the climb that they must make. Some of them are just lazy. Some were late repenters. Some were excommunicated. For some reason, Dante thought that people who were excommunicated could enter into purgatory, but they had to spend, is it 100 years, or I think it's 100 years in the anti-purgatory, the pre-purgatory, before they would be allowed to enter the purgatory proper. So there are all sorts of categories of people. There are the rulers who were incompetent or didn't do what they were supposed to do. That's a large group of people who he sees. And Dante we had time, I'd like to actually go into the political side of Dante, but he sees the political and the personal and the spiritual all related to one another, and that the disorders that exist in the public sphere are just as much part of this larger pilgrimage question as the ones that are in the private sphere. So anyway, there's plenty to warn us about here, that we could be ourselves wary about delaying the kinds of work we must undertake ourselves. And Father's exactly right. You don't have to wait till you have a midlife crisis to make sure you don't get into the very things that are going to keep you from following following the path you ought to take. There's another very interesting image, it seems to me, in the purgatory. Now, again, let's look at the whole structure. When the poets go down, they follow around, and they keep going down in the circles of hell. They're kind of going in a corkscrew way. And when they get to purgatory, they come out, they start going around the cornices as well in a corkscrew way. And there are only certain portals where you can go up to the next level, so they sometimes have to walk around quite a bit before they find what they're supposed to do. And he talks about how he's been following Virgil, mounting up and moving around the mountain. He says this to one of the souls, that makes you straight, whom the world made crooked. Now that's in most of the translations. What the Italian actually there is torto, which means kind of twisted. And so he makes it clear that the whole spiral movement that they've had going down through hell and then also coming up through purgatory is actually an untwisting of something that life has twisted so that they are not straight. Remember that word straight. I'm going to come back to that. There are two things that need untwisting in a human being, okay, so that we can see properly and that we can act properly. And both of these untwistings really come to fruition in the upper parts of purgatory. The first sign comes in canto 18. Remember, that's one of the two cantos near the center that I talked about. Neither creator nor creature was ever without love. That's where the center of the poem kind of expresses that everything is love, but there are evil loves, there are excessive loves, there are insufficient loves, etc. So in canto 18, Dante speaks and Virgil responds. Let me just read a few verses here. Master, my sight is so enlivened by your light that I grasp clearly all that your words explain or analyze. Therefore, I beg you, gentle Father dear, teach me this love to which you have reduced every good action and its opposite. Direct toward me, he answered, the sharp beams of your mind's eye. The eye and the intellect are often kind of interchanged in symbolic representations. And you shall plainly see the error of the blind passed off as guides. Now that's a plain statement, right? Virgil, as a kind of a pagan wisdom, is telling Dante, follow what I'm going to say to you. And he explains as much as he can. You remember, he says, you know, Beatrice is going to have to come. I can't get to the roots of good and evil. That's something that you can only understand from Christian enlightenment. But then a funny thing happens. And this is one of many funny things that we can talk about in Dante. Dante falls asleep. It's kind of like he was listening to a lecture and fell asleep. And he has a dream. And here's the dream. There's a beautiful woman who is a siren. Remember what the sirens were? They were these beautiful women who would sing and they would lure the sailors onto the rocks between, I think it's between Sicily and the mainland of Italy they pass through. So Dante says this about this siren in his dream. She then began to sing so that it would be hard for me to turn my eyes from her. Remember, eyes is intelligence. I am, she sang, I am the charming siren, she who allures the sailors in mid-sea, so fully pleasing am I to hear sing. I turned Ulysses from his longed-for journey to my songs, and he who dwells with me seldom departs. I satisfy so well. You know, these are the resonances going back to Casella and, you know, others, of course. Her mouth had not yet shut when at my side a lady, saintly and alert, appeared to thrust the siren into sheer confusion. "Oh, Virgil, Virgil, who is this?" she asked resentfully, and he came forward then with his eyes fixed on the high-minded one. She seized the other, meaning the one, the siren, stripped her bare in front, ripping her clothes, and showed me her belly. The stench that sprang from it awakened me. Now, we don't know who this lady is. It could be Beatrice, it could be the Virgin, it could be St. Lucy. Remember again, I told you about St. Lucy, that when Dante studied his 30 months of philosophy and theology, he had eye problems, so he became a devotee of St. Lucy. It may be her, because of that I saw, you know, he finally sees properly, and that awakens him. But already here, and this is kind of a figure for the kinds of things that happen in everyone's life, you get these divine interventions. Something tempts you, or something looks like it's a good. And right after Dante has had the explanation of the human loves, there actually is an occurrence of, in a dream, something coming from above that opens up the real truth to him. So part of that crookedness that has to be part of that twistedness that needs to be untwisted is that we see wrongly as well as act wrongly. And it's only after a certain purgation, we get to a certain level, that even our reasoning powers are going to be able to see through certain delusions, certain illusions, to the point that we can think properly about them. I think in this regard, there's a famous passage in Cardinal Newman's The Apologia Pro Vita Sua, where he talks about how he is not entirely a fan of sort of scholastic philosophy, excuse me, Dominicans in the room. And it's not because he doesn't admire Thomas and others. He does very much. But he says he's worried because reason is the kind of thing that was perfect before the fall, but in the current condition of human beings, reason is being done by an imperfect, twisted, crooked human being, and therefore reason itself can be twisted or can be crooked. Pope Benedict used to often quote Hegel, who used to say that reason has a wax nose and it can be turned in any direction. And maybe Hegel's reason could. I don't think Thomas's reason could quite be turned in any direction. But this is a good warning, right? I mean, this is a thing that we recognize, that lots of forms of rationality. I often think of analytic philosophy, excuse me if somebody's studying that right now, but it's this very precise, logical parsing out of words. And in a way, you could say that when you read an article of the Summa, that's exactly what Thomas is doing, right? He says, men have said, and he lays out all these positions that he knows. And he says, sed contra, there are all these other positions that contradict them. And then he says, respondeo, I respond to this. And what they're usually doing is trying to sort out the meaning of a word and see how it fits with other truths so that it's all self-consistent. But there are uses of reason, and I think a lot of analytic philosophies, particularly in Britain, is like this, that the use of reason is remarkable, and it's precise, and it's demonstrable at every point, but it seems to have no purpose. It's just, you know, clarifying terms without really, I think, involving the deepest things that human beings need to know. Now, I mentioned that the untwisting also requires us to have straighter wills. It seems to me one of the commonplaces about modern philosophy is that the will has played a larger role than it ever did in the past. If you look at Nietzsche or you look at Heidegger, the way that they're often read is that will, what human beings want to know, tends to become the truth for them, or it becomes a way to avoid a kind of an inauthentic truths that are imposed on us. And I think Dante and the whole Western tradition was quite aware of that, but there's a difference at the end of the day after you've reasoned these things through if you're more grounded in a kind of a realist philosophy. And I think that for me, where this is most graphically illustrated is when Dante has to finally be purged, his will has to finally be purged of lust. And he admits he's probably going to have to come back to this circle of purgatory later. Lust is the first sin that gets you into hell, and it's the last one when you're exiting from purgatory. And there's a wall of fire there. And he meets some very interesting poets, by the way. There's a wall of fire there. And he's terrified of going through this wall of fire. And Virgil says to him, look, if you put that fire won't burn one hair of your head, but you have to have faith that you can go through it. He's terrified. And so what Virgil does is he arranges it that he's in the front, Dante's in the middle, and this Roman poet Statius is in the back. So Dante gets shuffled along through the wall of fire by them, and he can't escape, and he comes out the other side, and now he's about to enter the earthly paradise. And a remarkable thing happens here. So he's had his vision somewhat purified, although after many readings of the paradise, I'm very much struck by how Dante keeps talking about how his vision grows when he's in paradise. He becomes capable of seeing more and more light. So there continues to be growth before he transcends the known universe. But they're on the other side, and his sight and his will are now purified. And this is what Virgil says to him. And this is in Canto 27 of Purgatory. I'm going to read it in Italian first, because it's very striking in Italian. It's just four lines. Non aspettar mio dir più nel mio cenno. Libero, dritto e sano è tuo arbitrio, e fallo fora non fare a suo senno. Perché io te sovra te corono e mitrio. And this is the translation. Await no further word or sign from me. Your will is free, erect, and whole. To act against that will would be to err. Therefore, I crown and mitre you over yourself. So that Dante, having achieved the earthly paradise now, is like those first people. He's his own ruler, and he's his own bishop in a way. Now, one of the great mysteries about the Divine Comedy is why Dante, the writer, thought that Virgil was in a position to crown and mitre Dante the pilgrim in the actual poem. But he does say that here. He says, te sovra te corono e mitrio. But we get the point. He is now himself whole and able to act on his own because his will is free. Remember Cato and freedom. Straight. Torto has been untwisted. E sano. Sano meaning, I don't know what, whole or healthy or something like that. All right, it's probably time for us to come to an end. And so, in a way, the earthly paradise, which Dante is now going to enter, itself is not part of purgatory. It's part of the book Purgatory. But once you enter the earthly paradise, you're not really in purgatory. But I'm just very briefly, since it's part of the book, I just want to make a couple of quick comments about purgatory. First of all, it's not without its pains, because Dante, when he meets Beatrice, she gives him a tongue lashing. She says to him, you know, when I was alive on earth and you saw my beauty, you should have stayed virtuous and holy. And instead you did, and we don't know what he did. There are lots of attempts by scholars to try to figure out what it is that he was unfaithful about. I think it's a pretty straightforward thing, since Dante says he's going to have to go back to the circle of lust, the terrace of lust in purgatory. But in any event, you know, she doesn't let, when they first meet again, it isn't like all loves and kisses. It's, you know, you should have been a man. And she actually says, raise up your beard. And he says, oh, he says, I really got that. I should have been a man. You know, I should have stayed faithful to her, right? What then happens is just utterly remarkable, because you would think in the earthly paradise things would be very simple. It would be like the first creation. And instead, Dante has this, the way that Beatrice comes to him is this elaborate allegory where she's in a chariot being drawn by a griffin. And there are these 24 elders, and then there are the four writers of the Gospels, and then there are these big candles that are drawing colors on the sky. And in effect, what this is the whole history of the human race. It's the Old Testament books that are walking along with her. It's the four gospel writers. It's the griffin, who's Christ drawing along. And then there are allegories about how the church is corrupted by the state and by the empire, and then one thing after another. I think the only way we can account for this is that once our will and our sight have been purified to the point that they're sane again, we see the whole history of humanity in a different light. We see all the things that have been great in the way that God entered time and throughout history had his revelation through the Jewish people and then into the church and then the ups and downs down to Dante's own time. But in any event, he's able to see things almost prophetically, some retrospective, some prospective, that could only happen to a soul who's a much purer soul than ours are. And it's a kind of an affirmation of what unfallen humanity, I think, would make of our human history. It's a vision that I think a lot of us would like to have, especially in troubled times like this, where we don't really know where the forces that are at play in the world and in the church are going to take us. But in a kind of paradoxical fashion, I think the fact that Dante places that out there at least gives us hope. It gives us a chance to think that we too can be consoled a bit by the fact that that truth, that vision is there, and that as we all make our own personal pilgrimages that are not going to be the same as Dante's, but they are going to follow along certain classical Christian lines, that the pilgrimage that all of us make at the end will not only bring us to beatitude, but it'll help us to understand things in this life and where the things in this life lead to the next.